Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the countdown to the sequester that is 4 days away, and with little hope of a break in the impasse, $85 billion will be automatically cut from a faltering economy, thus reversing economic recovery. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, joins us to discuss what last-minute deals could be struck and whether the Republicans will take note of the surprise resurrection of Silvio Berlusconi, who ran in the Italian elections as an anti-austerity candidate. Then we'll look into the extraordinary rise of defense spending during the last decade, increases not seen since the Korean War, and whether this can be slowed or reversed. A former defense and intelligence insider, Melvin Goodman, the author of a new book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, joins us. We will discuss whether the Republicans have changed their minds on defense cuts and if cuts could be targeted against useless weapon systems like the most expensive defense contract in history, the F-35 aircraft that is now grounded. Then finally, we'll assess the possibility of new leadership in Cuba with a former analyst with the Cuban government, Arturo Lopez Levy. We will discuss Sunday's announcement by Raul Castro that he will step down as Cuba's president in 2018 after completing a new 5-year term, and learn about the likely successor, the 52-year-old Miguel Diaz-Canel, an electrical engineer, one of 8 vice presidents who was promoted on Sunday to be the first vice president. Joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist, and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is an Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at the Institute for Global Leadership. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Is there any encouragement out there? Is there any hope? Is there any glimmer that we're not going to go, I don't have to use the going off the cliff analogy. That was the last one, right? What is this one? Going into
well,
the abyss?
Talking about the, I mean, I think we've been talking about the cliff for 18 months now. Right. But both in Italy this evening and also in the United States, I mean, you can choose which fiasco you want to focus on. I think it was Karl Marx who said that history repeats itself first as tragedy and twice as farce. And this is the fourth time that Italy has decided to elect Berlusconi. And so Italy, the right is basically saying we're not going to accept austerity. We're rebelling against it. We'd rather have more borrowing. In the United States, we have 4 days left from the sequester going into effect, and here the right is saying, no, we got to have more austerity. So it's kind of an interesting contrast. But I think there's plenty of fault to go around. I mean, on the U.S. side, we have, Obama originally suggested this crazy idea of having sequestration about 18 months ago. And, as part of the deal he agreed to, we would have these mandatory cuts in defense spending and discretionary domestic spending of about $1.2 trillion over 10 years. And he says now he never expected that actually to go into place, into effect. And, we would have a deal sometime between 18 months ago and now. But right now we're facing a situation that's pretty serious, because not only do we have the prospect of $85 billion of cuts just this fiscal year alone, and all those cuts have to be implemented within a 6-month time frame. So it's like the effect on the programs is actually about twice as what they would be as if they were spread over a whole year. But we also have the 2% payroll tax increase that's affecting most Americans who have payrolls or small businesses at this point, or wage workers, that's going into effect right now. So the combination here is the United States economy looks like it could very well go into a complete, slow growth period. It's already growing very modestly, but it could actually go back into recession as a result of these policies. So,
this is a 1-2 shot in the foot then, right?
Yeah, it is. And so you have, on the one hand, Europe basically going into gridlock because now Italy, which is the third largest economy in Europe, with a 2 trillion euro debt, much of which is owed to French and German banks, basically just elected a government that can't make a decision. And Berlusconi looks like he's controlling the Italian Senate, and the Chamber of Deputies is controlled by the center right, by the center left party, which is
feckless.
Bersani, which is basically more likely to want to implement an EU policy, but they won't be able to agree on anything. Both houses under Italian law have to agree on legislation. So, you know, basically, unless you have new elections, you're going to have kind of a gridlock there. And they're basically in a situation where the EU's program is basically stuck. So it's no accident the Italian bond premiums over the German debt today soared by about 15%. So you have already the markets reflecting the prospect that, you know, all of Southern Europe now is going to be fighting the austerity program that the Angela Merkel and you know, the Brussels has been trying to cram down the throats of, you know, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal.
You're telling us, it seems, James Henry, is that you've got the wrecking crew in Washington, and you've got the wrecking crew in Europe. That people have tried to put together these, you know, obviously flawed compromises, just so that we don't go off the cliff, to use that analogy again. And here you've got the Republicans about to blow it up here, and Berlusconi blowing it up in Europe.
Yeah, and I wouldn't put it all on the Republicans.
I know.
Neutral here. I think what you have is the failure of the political classes in both countries to come to any kind of compromised agreement here. In a situation that you would have thought there was all kinds of room for compromise. I mean, we're not talking about any more than a small fraction of federal spending, but Obama's put himself in a situation where he literally is unwilling to deal with Medicare or Social Security cuts. All of the cuts are going to be concentrated on the so-called discretionary programs, and those are things that are going to affect, you know, poor people, I mean, teachers, all kinds of the Head Start programs. You have, you know, public health services, fish and wildlife, the environment, everything but the so-called entitlement programs. It's also going to be affecting, defense spending in ways that are just kind of arbitrary. I mean, California is looking at 64,000 civilian DOD jobs being sequestered here right off the bat. You know, it's just a heck of a way to run a government. And I think going back to when Obama agreed to extend the Bush tax cuts, that's kind of the original sin here. He just neglected to get the Republicans to agree to lifting the debt ceiling. And so ever since that decision, I think that was in late 2010, we've been living with this situation. So, you know, basically, we're in this situation. There's a lot of fault to go around, but it's not going to be easily resolved.
So you mentioned that the president came up with the sequester idea, at least apparently Jack Lew did, according to Washington Post Bob Woodward.
Right.
So I guess I should apologize to, because I mentioned at one point that I thought that Mitch McConnell and John Boehner were making stuff up, but apparently they weren't. But the point is they signed on to it at any rate. So
yeah, according to Bob Woodward, I think he's pretty good on this. I think Obama had the idea. basically never expected it to go on.
But didn't they deliberately make it so unattractive that nobody would have done it? Wasn't that the whole idea?
Well, the bet was that the Republicans cared much more about defense spending than it turns out, in fact, they do. I mean, now that we're withdrawing from Afghanistan, we've already withdrawn from Iraq, the terrorist threat has been at least temporarily suppressed. So there's much less attention on the Defense Department. And apparently, the Republicans, who even those on the Defense Committee, have said in the last few days that they, at least for public consumption, that they care much more about sticking to the no tax increase party line that they've had than, about the potential impacts on defense spending. So, maybe Obama was betting too heavily on their being unwilling to cut defense spending or caring more about that than he cares about discretionary spending. So, in any case, there's no compromise in sight. I mean, Senator Reid has introduced a bill today, aimed at a kind of combination of tax increases and more targeted spending cuts on the order of $110 billion for the rest of the year. He's going after something called the Buffett rule, which is, the rule that allows people who are hedge fund managers to treat their incomes as subject to the capital gains rate of 15% rather than the kind of labor income tax rates the rest of us pay. It could go up to 35%. And that would be worth about $54 billion over 10 years. But that's not going to pass the House, the basic problem. He'll probably be able to get 60 votes for that bill this week. But, the House just is unlikely to pass that. So we're looking at a situation in which, the soft deadline is this Friday. The really hard deadline is more toward the end of March, when they have to pass the continuing resolution that lifts the debt ceiling. And they're supposed to come up with, some more detailed approaches to these, to spending and taxes over the next few years. So, we're passing through this period right now where people who are deciding whether to invest, people are looking at, whether they're going to be, they should be borrowing to buy houses. And, there are a lot of decisions that are going to be placed on hold during this period of uncertainty. That's the biggest impact, is the uncertainty that all this Washington nonsense kind of creates for the rest of the economy.
Well, but it does seem, though, that, James Henry, that when you fault the president for not being sort of tactically his tactical antennae not being such that he should have noticed that they were going to use. I mean, how could he have in other words, can one expect a president to expect the opposing party to use the debt ceiling as a weapon repeatedly and repeatedly? I mean, obviously he should have included in the deal, or if he could.
I'm sort of, this is a unfair to the president. I mean, I think we're all wishing it were otherwise, and we have to put the blame somewhere. If you're looking at what Obama might have done differently, whether any sitting president would have ever expected the Republicans to be this, sort of uncompromising is a different question. I mean, probably it was a reasonable bet for him to make that they would, at the end of the day, become more willing to compromise. But nevertheless, you can point to these moments in time when he took one path rather than another. He did sign up for the sequestration deal. He did sign up for this bet that they would, that he could count on them to waive the debt ceiling or raise the debt ceiling. And in both cases, he was, counting on their being more willing to compromise than they turned out to be. So I'm not calling that I mean, it may be something that no mortal man could have foreseen, but those are some of the critical decisions that were made here.
Well, it does seem that the president's current tactic is to try and shame the Republicans because He wants to close loopholes on the ultra wealthy, the hedge funds managers, again, he's sort of saying that you guys are protecting the privileges of the millionaires and billionaires, and I'm trying to stand up for the average American working and middle class American. So whether or not that's going to work, what explains, I mean, I know there are some ideologues on the Republican side that came in with the Tea Party, like Rand Paul, who's a libertarian. They have extremely rigid ideas that are often deeply impractical, but they're very heartfelt. And then you've got people like Tom Coben, who comes out of the Bible Belt, and he's absolutely obsessed with deficits. How do you reach these people?
Well, there's a handful, first of all, of Republicans who are, you know, care more about military spending. People like McCain, for example, Susan Collins, you know, there maybe Lindsey from, you know,
South Carolina.
South Carolina. I think there are, first of all, there's that faction within the Republican Party that may be more willing to, you know, give the president some latitude here, and agrees that the, you know, these defense cuts are going to be absolutely arbitrary. There are probably some Republicans that, you know, are willing to think twice before they would vote simply to protect the wealth of hedge fund managers around the country, which is pretty astronomical anyway. But, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't done the head count, and I'm not sure how many folks are in those categories. I think that this could probably, the Reid bill will probably pass the Senate. I think it will get 60 votes in the Senate, including those, some of those Republicans I just mentioned. The difficulty is with the hardcore in the House, who seem to have, if anything, become more intransigent during this period. And that's where, you know, I think the problem really lies here. So
that would mean then, would it not, James Henry, that the real, the kind of, what shall I say, the undercurrents that will affect this are how obdurate the House can be for how long if they're hearing back from their constituents that are at defense plants that are closing in their districts. Is that the new dynamic?
Yeah, I think that they're betting that they put the president in a position where it's going to be affecting Democrats as well as Republicans for there to be all these very obvious cutbacks around the country. And it's, you know, they're going to put the burden, try to put the pressure on him to consider deeper cuts in the entitlement areas like Medicare and Social Security. I think that's the game that they're playing. They're going to say no to any tax cut increases, and, you know, try to get the president to come back with, you know, spending cuts in those areas that have so far been off the table. So I don't think that'll work. I mean, I think that most Americans will look at the, you know, sort of look at the consequences of this, and those consequences will begin to become apparent pretty quickly. You know, blame it on the hardcore element in the House that basically are Republicans. And, you know, Obama deserves responsibility for much of the problem, but at the end of the day, those are the people that are going to be, I think, held accountable for the cuts here. So it may take until the, you know, 2014 congressional elections for us to see the impacts here. But if you see, as we expect to see, you know, something like 70,000 Head Start kids deprived. 10% cuts in the level of unemployment benefits. 40,000 teachers laid off nationwide. I mean, these are impacts that are really going to hit hard. And most Americans are a little bit oblivious to this. They don't necessarily understand the role that the federal government plays in all of these social programs that they take for granted.
Well, I don't think the president is helping his own cause by talking about having the FAA and the transportation secretary go out there and say, talk about airplane flights being delayed. Why doesn't they make the case that you just made, for God's sake?
You have to ask him. I mean, the president is well advised. He has the, you know, probably the deepest pockets of any Democratic president in history. He's got tiers and tiers of advisors on the media. He's just announced this program, Organization for America, which is raising $50 million from very wealthy people, $500,000 a crack, or at least from bundlers. So he's got his eyes on trying to make the case over the next few months to the American people about, how this is all working and who's responsible for it. I think it would have, a substitute for all that would have just been to call the, have a summit for the congressional leaders and declare this a kind of national emergency. And the United States is looking like a basket case. And, it's hard to make this look like an achievement in terms of our role in the world. You've already seen the fiasco in Europe. We can't really afford to have the United States is still about a third of the world economy. We can't really afford to be governed the way Italy is. So, we need to actually have a president who stands up and calls people in and says it's time for us to get serious and to resolve this problem. If we can't resolve this problem, then there are so many other problems that are even more fundamental. How will we ever tackle those? But, so far he's been kind of unwilling to, there's a level of disdain for his opponents that I think doesn't really serve him well and certainly hasn't helped to break this deadlock.
Well, James Henry, I thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, quite welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist and former chief economist at McKinsey & Company. He is the Edward R. Murrow Fellow at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and Inspire Fellow at its Institute for Global Leadership. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about whether sensible defense cuts can be made, like the most expensive defense contract in history, the F-35 aircraft that is now grounded.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, sure, take all that you see to me.